Welcome to Place Matters, a podcast about the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to the next installment of our series on FCS's three pillars. This series will focus on the pillar of mixed income housing. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting for FCS and the host for Place Matters. In the mid-20th century, our cities were emptying out for the suburbs. By 1970, the majority of the American population was in the suburbs. Over the last couple of decades, that trend has been reversing and the pace of urbanization is speeding up. With the massive population shifts and the renewed investment in urban development, we are faced with a very real and pressing challenge of having enough housing, especially enough housing that is affordable to individuals and families across the economic spectrum. For those of us in the industry, it can feel overwhelming and the picture sometimes can seem bleak. However, there are so many courageous and creative people working to innovate and expand how we work for justice and equity. It is a core practice for us to stay in touch with those practitioners and pioneers who give us reasons for hope and inspiration for the next leg of the journey. And joining me today to talk about their hope for the future of housing is FCS President Jim Wehner and two special guests, Carol Naughton and Alan Ferguson Sr. Carol is the Chief Executive Officer of Purpose Built Communities, which is a nationwide network of place-based organizations who, among other things, share a commitment to quality, affordable, mixed-income housing. And Alan is the President and CEO of Atlanta Habitat for Humanity.
Well, thank all of you for making time to be a part of this conversation. In your own worlds and right are just experts in this field and are leaders in this industry. And I'm excited for our listeners to have a chance to sit in on this conversation as we talk about affordable housing and how we think about through the lens of place. So I actually want to start there. I think if you've got a pulse and are paying attention to whatever city you live in, you know there's an affordable housing issue going on. And we're all in that space of affordable housing, but I think we would all say affordable housing kind of in a silo is very different than approaching affordable housing from a place-based lens. What's the difference, or how does a place-based lens impact the way we think about affordable housing?
Ooh, that's a hard one. Carol, you go first.
All right, I'll go first. So thank you. I'm delighted to be here with Jim, Alan, Sean. This is a fun opportunity. Thank you for including me. At Purpose Built Communities, the way we think about place is place as a neighborhood. And we would describe ourselves as neighborhoodists, not necessarily a word that, you know, rolls right off the tongue, but we believe that everybody in this country deserves to live in a healthy, wonderful neighborhood that supports them on their life's journey. And so for us, place is the neighborhood. We're working with other people around the country, though, who think about place in a very different way. People who think about place as a whole city, place as a region. And so I think it's important for us to think about how, with our organizations and our work, how do we filter place? What does it mean to us? And from Purpose Built standpoint, it's about creating wonderful, healthy neighborhoods that lift everybody up and connect them with their aspirations.
I really appreciate that clarification. I think that's really helpful because I think for us that get so used to talking about place this and place based that, for a lot of people that means something very, very different than what we're saying. So in our context, we really are thinking about the confines of very specific neighborhood and thinking city-based neighborhood, not subdivision that gets called neighborhood, but it's just a collection of houses. We're talking about an entire lived, work, play ecosystem of a neighborhood within a city. So yeah, thank you. That's a really good clarification. And so when we approach affordable housing from that lens of healthy neighborhoods, what changes when we do that?
Well, I'll jump in. And hey, everyone, glad to be here and join this conversation as well. So when we think about, you know, place in the context of healthy neighborhoods, really what you're talking about are what are those things, what are those fundamentals that are there that you can connect with that add to the quality of life, not just, you know, providing, you know, affordability in the housing sense, but where is the access to transportation, for example, or the connection to job centers, or the connection to, you know, education, and to recreation and green space, and all of those things that really make for a healthy quality of life. And even more pronounced, I think, in today's day and age, versus how affordable housing was thought of, you know, in the prior context, is really making sure that you have all of those linkages in addition to connections to amenities and services. So many places are wonderful places where great housing has been built, but there's still a disconnect between, you know, residents being able to access local amenities and services. Again, those are the things that add to the, you know, entire picture of the quality of life for folks.
Yeah, that I would add to what Alan is saying, which is I think right online, but I think how does neighborhood impact housing? Well, the neighborhood dictates a little bit as the type of housing that you might produce. It can dictate, for instance, whether you're building, if you're working for a mixed income in the neighborhood, it can impact the type of single family housing you do. It can even impact whether you do rentals or whether you're doing for sale, what level of for sale you're doing, but it can impact the look of the houses you're building. Like if you're building to be cohesive with current neighborhood, it can mean that the architecture, the outside aspects of what you build can change. The neighborhood we're in does not have a lot of multifamily, so we've been working to solve for that. I would say the last 3 or 4 years, where we spent a good number of years working to solve for affordable home ownership in the neighborhood. And not that we don't still do that, but the neighborhood can impact the rate or the type, the rate of housing that you build or the type of housing that you build, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we have a client that we've been working with, and some of their, so they're a nonprofit, and they've been doing a mix of type of housing in the neighborhood where they're working. And they've been getting some pushback on some of their kind of audience or followers or donors are like, why are you not just doing all strictly this, you know, type A of this type of housing? And they're having to get in this kind of rinse and repeat conversation. We're not trying to solve a housing problem. We're trying to solve a neighborhood health problem. And like when that becomes a lens, all of a sudden you start, as you guys have mentioned, there's the equation all of a sudden gets way more complicated because all these new variables that come into play throughout that type of work. And so, you know, again, affordable housing crisis, I feel like that's easy on the lips of a lot of people. And one of the things that Jim and I will say when we're talking with groups is that all of our neighborhoods and cities are working perfectly because we've designed them to do exactly what they're doing, right? We may not like the results, but the machine is producing what we built the machine to produce. So you guys have a great national, regional, local perspective on this big issue of housing. What has happened to get us in this spot that we're in now? If we've designed the problems that we're currently experiencing the results of, what does that mean? What happened to get us into this place that we're in right now?
I'll jump in for a sec. I mean, I think the question is, if you're thinking about neighborhoods and not just affordable housing, I think the first thing we would say, the very intentional and malintended policies of our federal, state, and local governments over the last 150 years and longer, that were designed to make life harder for Black and brown people and advantage white people. And, you know, that's fundamentally the problem that we're working to solve. And for us, using a neighborhood lens is part of how you do that, rather than just attacking the housing issue, which is a big and important issue, but it's only part of it, as we've heard from Alan and Jim and me. I mean, we recognize that thinking about the neighborhood and all of the aspects that create an opportunity-rich ecosystem are essential for creating places that really will drive economic mobility, better health outcomes, and racial equity.
That is great. A great answer to that. I think one of the things that we're talking about regularly, where you use the term opportunity rich, Carol, to describe sort of the vision of what we'd like for every neighborhood, One of the terms that we're talking about, it's in our sort of regular processing, is this idea of concentrated forces of inequity that we want to sustainably change those places that have concentrated inequity. And I don't know if you want to explain that a little bit, Sean. Mm-hmm. I think you do a better job than I do on that. But this concentration of forces, like we were meeting with a board member last Friday, and one of the things he remembers me saying is that neighborhoods have gravitational pull, and that concentrated mm-hmm. forces idea forms a gravitational pull that keeps people, holds them in place in an unhealthy way often. And mm-hmm. we wonder, can we flip that script so that it becomes opportunity rich and a gravitational pull toward economic mm-hmm. and social and personal vitality? That mm-hmm. idea, to me, sort of indicates at the base level of what we're trying to do, not only with housing, with other work we do, but specifically with housing, mm-hmm. can we create neighborhoods that, as Carol said, are rich in opportunities?
Mm-hmm. I want to, Jim, say how much I appreciate that framing of concentrated mm-hmm. forces of inequity rather than talking mm-hmm. about concentrated yep. poverty, right? Because mm-hmm. when we use mm-hmm. the term concentrated poverty, there's a bit that leaves the listener thinking about it's the victims of these policies and yeah. practices that right. are the problem, rather than mm-hmm. thinking about mm-hmm. the systems that drove those concentrated forces of inequity. So I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Just trademark it, Jim White.
Yep, yep.
Yeah, Jim, I was just reading about the narrative of Jeffrey Canada's work with Harlem Children's Zone. It's been out for a while, but I was reading it recently, and he uses that language as well about the gravitational pull. And he talks about some of our interventions, like, can keep kids or people in the air for a while, but like, we've got to do enough in the ecosystem for escape velocity, was his metaphor. Like, how do you actually break that? And so that the neighborhood is no longer this force towards inequity. And of course, housing is a massive part of all of that, but the ability to say we're really thinking about this entire ecosystem and how is our affordable housing actually part of that gravitational pull towards inequity? Like the way that we concentrate so much of our affordable housing all in the same spots rather than kind of moving that about. And so again, back to this like crisis we're in on a housing shortage, which makes things, you know, just completely unaffordable and unreasonable. You know, it's not like we just had like a population boom. You know, it's not like we're surprised by how many humans there are. And urbanization has been going on long enough. We're not shocked by the number of people moving to cities. Like, so what is going on that is created that means there is such a shortage of housing, which means therefore there's such a lack of affordability, even for middle income folks.
And higher.
What got us
yeah.
in that spot?
And higher. Yeah. And higher. Right? Yeah. I mean, it's a housing crisis all the way.
Atlanta calls affordable. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, I've been in the depression world for, I don't know, 25 years, and I'm educated, and you know, I can't even reach this stuff that's considered affordable mm-hmm. these days. So what got us to a place where there is such a shortage that's creating this kind of unreasonable threshold of,
you know,
of housing?
I think it really starts with, you know, public policy around land use and zoning. Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. many, you know, cities, you know, I would say over time that were very urban, that were very, you know, densely populated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in order to, you know, feel like, you know, they wanted to retain and attract residents that were moving out to more suburban areas and ex-urban areas, mm-hmm. really kind of adopted, you know, policies that limited the amount of density that you could have. And so mm-hmm. what you end up having is, you know, our situations, quite frankly, you know, under the zoning code where, you know, certain housing types that were allowed that accommodated more people living concentrated in more areas and kind of helping with housing supply, you know, those policies went by the wayside in favor of, you mm-hmm. know, very distinct, you know, descriptive and limited policies around, you know, single family zone use. Not that any, you know, I'm in the single mm-hmm. family business. And so not that we're, against single family or anything, but when you look at that as a housing type and being restrictive in regards to how many units that you can place on a single lot, you're actually reducing the supply of available housing, which over time contributes to this overall, shortage that we're experiencing now. And I think even if you look at, areas outside of urban areas and suburban communities, they're kind of experiencing, a very similar thing where if you look at some of the older suburbs that have, zoning requirements of 1/3 and some even a half an acre or a minimum lot size, and you come back to those neighborhoods 20, 30 years later and you realize that they just don't have the density in order to support, the neighborhood services, those, entering urban suburban communities are being challenged as well. So that also contributes, to the housing shortage.
Yeah, and it's interesting the battles that get fought that are race implicit battles about inclusionary versus exclusionary zoning and the language of like just wanting to protect the character of the neighborhood or the size or style of our housing. And a lot of places like we don't want people with less incomes and we don't want black and brown in these places. And like, but again, it's like that's when we say the system's designed to get us here is like we've kind of baked in and only a certain type of person is going to be able to live here based on the requirements we put around. As bland of a phrase as zoning might sound, that's the stuff.
I think we also need to look at, with the impact of the financial crisis back in 2008, 2009, which, we never really recovered from in terms of building housing again. We've kind of lost the muscles that we used to have in terms of creating more housing units because of that crisis. And there were so many things that created that crisis. I'm not advocating for return to those times, but I am advocating for figuring out how we actually deliver more houses. As Alan said, get the policies right, and it makes it easier for people to deliver, great quality housing that works in a variety of different situations. And then now we're also looking at the housing costs, land costs, the production has gone up so much faster than wages, right? So what used to be a problem 10 years ago, 15 years ago, is now exponentially worse as a result of those two lines progressing at different trajectories.
And I think Jim could say we felt that the income stagnation and the rising housing costs pretty profoundly in our neighborhood. But Jim, what would you may not know the exact ratio, but like what we could do 10 houses for 6-7 years ago, how many were you able to do for that same?
I would say over 10 years, our costs of housing creation have almost doubled. Our costs of acquisition have tripled, if not more. So just to put that in perspective a little bit, a property that we might be acquiring, let's say 2013, 2014, so sort of recovering from the economic crash, not fully recovered, we could acquire a vacant lot for $50,000 or less, and that same lot is $120,000 to $150,000. And there's no difference. The lot hasn't changed. Wow. It's just the demand and the values have said that this is what it costs to acquire that lot now. And then construction prices in general, coming through the pandemic and that we watched construction prices go up by a minimum 40%. And we would say some of those have come back down, but labor has not. So construction prices, when you're including labor, are a solid 35, close to 40% above where they were probably 3 to 4 years ago. So it's just a reality. I think in Atlanta, we're talking about area median income, which is a tool we all use in the affordable mixed income housing arena. In Atlanta, I want to say our area median income for 2023 is now at $103,000, which means if you're building something for a family, 50 to 80% of that those are family households that are earning between $50,000 and $80,000. That's a lot of money in today's, like when Carol talks about wages haven't kept up. This is why affordability, when not, don't think affordable housing, but when we think affordability, it's middle income and down. I mean, it, you know, you made the joke, Sean, of you work for a nonprofit. I actually know what you make.
And, don't tell anybody.
But my guess is you fall within that affordability matrix because the area median income is rising. So the tool that we use to sort of declare the swath of families or individuals that we're helping with housing has even been impacted by these rising prices and income not keeping up.
And Jim, I'd like to you know, just piggyback on something that you mentioned, which I think, you know, kind of gets lost in the conversation around affordable housing, and that it really is about housing affordability and the notion that, you know, in our spaces, we've traditionally focused on, you know, that demographic, that income of between, you know, 50 and 80% of area median income, sometimes dipping a bit lower. Now, because of rising, you know, incomes, you know, within the area, as well as the housing shortage, you're seeing the prospect of getting access to good quality housing being out of reach for that middle income bracket. Those are the folks that, you know, a decade ago, we would say, you know, hey, you're not eligible for affordable housing. Really, you should take advantage of these programs and things of that nature, and you should go into conventional, you know, home ownership. Now that's become unattainable. And so it just creates this crunch, if you will, for available, affordable housing throughout the income spectrum. And unfortunately, those who are least equipped to, you know, play that game, you know, to, you know, they're the ones who are losing out here, the lower income demographic.
That's right. So all the pressure at the higher end and the middle end and the lower middle end put additional pressure on the very lowest income families and those of us trying to provide great housing for the very lowest income families.
So to put it in very sort of simple terms that people, I mean, we're talking teachers, we're talking police officers, we're talking any sort of public servant service jobs. These are good jobs. These are professional jobs that from an income level are getting pushed out of the opportunity of home ownership, and which one super happy to have Alan on. I think there's probably nobody that fights for affordable home ownership like Habitat for Humanity across the US and really across the world with their programs. They have fought for that for years now. And we still need to be fighting for affordable home ownership, not just rental. We do, rental is definitely part of the equation, but affordable home ownership is that in the US economy, it is still critical to wealth building for families and individuals. And we should be passionate about making it available for people. It stabilizes families in neighborhoods. It keeps children in the same schools. It keeps families near their work and their jobs. I mean, there's just so many reasons to choose home ownership if we can help families or individuals into that. And I would say it's not a bleak vision. It is getting harder, which makes us work harder to want to do it. Maybe I would say there's some increasing subsidy to make it work well, but we could still do that. We could also do it as a nation if we set our mind to it, our sort of political will to making sure that families have a safe, wholesome, winsome place to live that brings stability. It's just such an important mission. And I love that. I mean, we're not talking about people that we don't know. We all know families that or individuals that are in this income range that we're talking about.
Hey guys, just want to jump in here real quick with an invitation. If you want to bring FCS's principles and practices to your neighborhood, we can take you and your local partners through a two-year multi-sector cohort process that we call City Shapers. Right now, this effort is being partially funded by Lilly Endowment, Inc., so it is a great time to jump in. We have taken three communities through this process so far and would love to bring it to your neighborhood next. Contact us today to learn more at fcsministries.org.
I mean, it's the level of complexity to these challenges can't be understated or overstated. It's just it's beyond comprehension on days. But my guess is you guys believe it's solvable, or at least a difference can be made, or you wouldn't wake up and do the jobs you'd go do something. You'd find a more lucrative and less stressful way to live your lives, would be my guess. So is it solvable? And if so, who's got to be at the table? What's it going to take? Like, how do we create a more equitable future than what we have now?
Yeah, I for one, I think it absolutely, is solvable. And, Jim, you made some great comments around, the benefits of, of doing this work, and especially, particularly in the home ownership space. I think the more that we, talk with all of the different, stakeholders in this, because it's broad, it's a broad group of stakeholders. Mm-hmm. You're not just talking about, your local and state and federal officials and public policy, but you're talking about, the educational institutions. You're talking about the employers. Mm-hmm. You're talking about, those who are, concerned around, climate and those types of issues. It's a really broad base of stakeholders, but the more that we can talk about and really help people understand all of the positive outcomes that come from having a quality, safe, affordable place to live, regardless of whether you rent or own that space, just having that certainty and having that foundation in order to build greater opportunities for your life. I think, we can attract more people and more diverse, and disparate organizations, together to try to, tackle, these issues. But to really, really attack it is going to take everybody understanding that they've got a stake in the outcomes of trying to produce, more housing.
So amen to all of that. And I do think it's solvable. I think we know the tools, we know what works, we know what doesn't work. I think the real issue that we have here, though, is creating kind of a national vision and a real recognition about how increasing the rate of home ownership, it benefits everybody, right? And we have lost some of those muscles over the last 25, 50 years. And I think part of what we all do is trying to build organizations and build neighborhoods where we create spaces for those conversations to happen at the neighborhood level. And I think that's a really important part of creating that national vision. We've got to build vision, build power at a neighborhood level about what we want to see happen, and build the public policies as a result of pressure and appetite from communities. Politicians will say that they're in favor of these things, but they respond when voters care, right? And so it's going to take lots of really specific actions, people coming together across race and income and ethnicity in order to create advocacy groups to drive this kind of conversation. Can't just come from philanthropy, can't just come from the banks. It's got to come from people on the ground who care about them. I think all the work that we all do is part of that and part of creating, frankly, an America that cares about one another more than it seems like we do right now. Don't get me going.
I love it. Come on, preacher. Just keep rolling forward.
So I've got a question. I don't want it to derail, so you can choose whether it stays in or not, Sean. But I wonder about the impact of current investment processes that are sort of turning housing and even home ownership into a commodity. So it's now an investment process that makes it a blatant return on investment, right? It's, we have investors, and FCS mm-hmm. does this. Like we have a rotational capital fund. We have investors that we borrow from to be able to do our work. But on a big scale across the U.S., we're watching big investment come in and buy mm-hmm. up real estate. And it's turned real estate at the neighborhood level into a commodity such that it's now mm-hmm. bought and traded fairly easily, even if the prices seem high to us. And I wonder about that impact mm-hmm. to us as we're looking at neighborhood. And Carol, you might be able to talk about network members of purpose-built communities that are experiencing this in their neighborhoods. I certainly can talk about it in our neighborhood that we're working in, but I just wonder about that idea. And do you have thoughts on it? And do you hear conversations on this?
Yeah. Are you asking me if I have an opinion, Jim?
Well, you know I want your opinion. So
So I'm just going to say, I think this is one of the worst things that has happened in the mm-hmm. last 50 mm-hmm. years is, you know, Wall Street, hedge funds, investment companies just coming in and buying lots, particular houses and lots, particularly in black and brown, undervalued neighborhoods. And maybe they sell them, maybe they hold on to them, maybe they mm-hmm. rent them. It is one of the worst things that has happened because, Jim, to your point earlier, home ownership has been one of the ways that we've created a middle exactly. class in this country. And owning a mm-hmm. home, owning something that appreciates in value, is critical. Mm-hmm. And now we've got these big finance people coming in and buying up houses that should be, in my mind, should be accessible mm-hmm. to regular people to be able to buy. And every one of our network members can say, this is a problem in our neighborhood. We can't compete with mm-hmm. people who are coming in with all cash, no inspection, that they're coming in. And again, what their intent is only to wait for the appreciation of the property and sell it at a certain point. They're not mm-hmm. they're not all in, right? Yeah. They're not even flipping it.
Yeah.
They're just buying it and holding it. Oh, and don't get me started about those rental people.
Really quick, just a clarifying question. Are you anti-Wall Street? No. I mean it seriously.
No,
right.
So no.
Neither am I.
I am a capitalist, right? Yeah, I am a capitalist. Capitalism and
yes,
we can do better. Right?
Yeah.
We can do better. It's not merely, it's just kind of running amok right now, and we don't have any regulatory framework to put caps on this, right? So I'm not suggesting that I am not a capitalist or don't love capitalism. Mm-hmm. I just say this is running amok, and it is is piling inequity on inequity.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I completely agree with you, Carol, and co-sign on the notion. What I will say, mm-hmm. however, is that trying to look for and wait for a regulatory type of solution for this. We, quite honestly, we'll be waiting for decades, before anything happens.
Yeah.
Trying to, get policymakers to do something about it from a regulatory standpoint, is just going to take a heavy lift. But what I do think we can do is we can actually learn from the models that they are doing and figure out how to implement those types of models in a more equitable, type of fashion.
Yeah.
Because when you look at it and essentially what they've done, it's something, they've got competitors, it's not just one big firm, there are multiple firms. So, they figured out how to do this. We can take those same types of learnings, those same types of models, and with different players involved and a different type, a capital structure, yep. you know, get involved in, you know, in the same type of game, so that mm-hmm. at least we can offer a competitive solution mm-hmm. that is actually, you know, more equitable and, quite frankly, more humane to some of these communities, you know, that are trying to serve.
Somebody asked me last year what I would do with $100 million. Yeah. And this is exactly what I said I would do, is I'd create a fund to go out and start buying houses in neighborhoods and have those houses controlled by community quarterbacks or other neighborhood-centered organizations, right? Who were thinking about it in a way that was not just about how much money can I make for myself and my shareholders, but how do we control this land, the one resource that they're not making any more of, right? How do we get control of that and be able to compete against those folks?
Yeah, for sure.
And what are some signs of hope for you guys? So you all sit in seats where you see hyper-local things happening, you see national, regional things happening. Like what, and you know, because the problem is so complex, there's so many difficult things we're solving every day, we have to pull our heads up and be like, there's that sign of hope. There's that piece of success that keeps me going. Like, what are some of those things for you guys? What are you looking at and seeing that really gives you like that? This is the hopeful sign that keeps me motivated.
Could I jump on that? One of the things that's most hopeful to me because I really believe that sort of ground level change happens at the local level, and it has been fun having our current mayor. That has a vision for neighborhoods, a vision for affordable housing, and a vision for the community quarterback organization. And what I'll say is this, like everyone, he's working to resource, and that is not easy. It takes time to build resources. But what it feels like as a sort of leader of a community quarterback is I know the city from a vision standpoint has my back. And that feels very different in the last 2 years than it had felt in the recent past. And that's been very encouraging for me. That's one of the places where I feel like, oh, I'm hopeful because I feel like I can call up the city when we need help with something, and whether they can do it right away or not, it just depends on the size of the ask and how it fits in. But the fact that that idea will be received and thoughtfully cared about is no doubt in my mind, I think. So that's one of the things I'm hopeful about.
Yeah. Absolutely. I would, you know, echo those, you know, points, Jim. I would, you know, actually say one of the things that I'm really encouraged about is not only, you know, things looking at the city of Atlanta and the activity that's happening here, but also what appears to me to be like a great revelatory moment regarding the communities outside of the city, recognizing and understanding that housing affordability is a challenge and an issue for them as well. Mm-hmm. So now you have all of these, you know, suburban communities, which historically, you know, would, you know, say, oh yeah, there's affordable housing. They're called old dilapidated apartments and they're over there. Now they're being very proactive and really understanding that housing affordability is a part of their suburban community and also a part of their economic, you know, vitality for all of the businesses and the jobs that they're creating and attracting. They need workers. And if those workers don't have a place to live in their communities, it's going to be very, very difficult for those enterprises to succeed. So they're finally getting the point that housing affordability is a integral issue of their pursuing their goals.
I plus one to Alan's and Jim's optimism. I think I'm excited by the research that we're seeing come out from folks like Raj Chetty and Opportunity Insights that demonstrates how much place matters and how much neighborhood matters and how important mm-hmm. it is to create mixed income opportunities for kids of all different backgrounds to get to know each other and become friends over time, and what a engine that is for economic mobility. I think all of those things are great. I think there's more interest in neighborhoods from a philanthropic and political standpoint than we've seen in a long time. And I think that's all good too. So neighborhoods are having a moment. They need mm-hmm. to have more moments, and over long term, we need to recognize that this is long-term work that needs to be mm-hmm. sustained for many, many years. Shirley Franklin used to try to get me to appreciate that when we were thinking about strengthening neighborhoods, we should have a 50 and 100-year lens on what we're doing. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be thinking of, you know, we'll see progress in 5 years and 10 years and whatnot, but are we creating neighborhoods that will be platforms for families for generations? And I think people in power, people with access to philanthropy, researchers are all thinking along those lines now in ways that where they weren't aligned even just a decade ago.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Carol. I feel like 8 to 10 years ago, people that were learning about what FCS did, like, well, what book would you kind of point to? And it was like kind of a chapter here, an article there. Yeah. And there wasn't a lot. I was just like, now I'm like, I'll give you a list of 12. Like, there's just like, there's so many more things that are just really rich and beautiful. And I'm like, this is a moment, I think, locally with, as Jim's point, with the mayor and the partnerships we have in Atlanta, there's a lot of hope. But I think even at a national level, there's an awakening in this. And I think this is a moment for those place-based folks like you guys to really kind of take center stage and say, this is our way. If we want a more equitable future in this country, neighborhood by neighborhood, this is the way we do it. So thank you guys. This is just awesome.
Well, I want to give a plug. I just read David Erickson's new book called The Fifth Freedom. Mm-hmm. If you get a chance, take it out. I mean, it really elevates neighborhoods as the solution to strengthening neighborhoods as the solution to these concentrated inequities.
Oh,
and give some really good examples of where we could be moving forward. So it's a great read. He's a great writer, a really great thinker. So take a look at it when you have a chance.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you for that. Thank you for that. Awesome. And thank you guys for the work that you do, just the stage that you're setting, the change that you're creating, and for joining this conversation. It was a delight for me to be a part of this. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks, you guys.
The best way to learn about our housing work and everything else we do is to come and see it for yourself. We love hosting guests in our neighborhood and at FCS. Coming March of 2024, we will be hosting a 2-day immersive event that we simply call Open House. Come, meet our team, see the work, and walk the neighborhood. To register, go to fcsministries.org/openhouse. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you'd like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in your show notes. If you'd like to watch these episodes, the video can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you did like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rose with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park and Becca Klein at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. And we would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment Incorporated, whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.